Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Today's episode is sponsored by Agro Seltzer. They think we're lazy.
They think we're weak-willed.
They think we're entitled.
They think we're selfish.
They think we don't care about anybody but ourselves.
We are compassionate.
We are resourceful.
We are capable.
We want to make a difference in the world.
We are underestimated.
Hi, I'm Tegan.
I'm McKenna.
I'm Brendan.
And I'm Emery.
And this is the first episode of Michigan's Missing Angels with the Underestimated podcast. For us, this investigative journalism class isn't just about learning how to write a headline or conduct an interview. It's about the power of accountability. It's about understanding that behind every cold case file is a human being, a family, and a community left with a void. This class has taught us that journalism is a tool, one we can use to give a voice to those who can no longer speak for themselves.
Our task for the semester was straightforward but daunting. Identify a cold case, research it, and use modern media to bring renewed public attention to it. We aren't looking for just any story. We were looking for a case where we felt our voices would truly make a difference in the search for the truth.
We felt a pull toward Kim Larrow's case, not just because it happened in our home state, but because of the unanswered questions that still linger 45 years later. We found Kim Larrow's case while digging through local archives and missing persons databases. Kim was only 15 years old when she disappeared from Canton, Michigan in 1981.
Our goal with this podcast is to bridge the gap between 1981 and today, bringing Kim's story to a new generation and hopefully uncovering the pieces of information that finally brings her home.
We are looking into the disappearance of Kim Marie Larrow, a 15-year-old girl who vanished from Canton Township, Michigan in June of 1981. This case is more than 40 years old. It has gone cold, changed hands, and pushed to the side. However, for the people who still care about Kim, it has never really gone away. The more we research Kim's case, the more we realize that her story might not stand alone. Over time, investigators started looking at whether her disappearance could be connected to convicted killer Arthur Rehm. So, this first episode is about three things: who Kim was, what happened the night she disappeared, and why Arthur Rehm's name later entered the conversation. This is not the story of a solved case, but an unsolved one. It is a story about what is known, what is not, and why people are still searching for answers.
Kim was born to Arnold and Lucy Larrow in Canton, Michigan. When Arnold and Lucy split up, Kim decided to live mainly with her father. She had a brother who she never saw because they lived with the other parent. Kim helped out at her dad's bar from time to time as well. Kim was lonely for most of the time and didn't know many people, and she only had a few friends but wanted to have more. She started to hang around older kids and started experimenting with alcohol and other substances at the time. She had run away from home several times in 1980, most recently to go to her grandparents in Florida with a friend. Members of her family have said something that stands out. They said that when Kim would run away, she would usually get in contact with someone. In other words, she may have ran, but she did not just vanish without a trace. Kim had only recently moved back to Canton from Dundee. She had been there for about a week, staying with her mother on Beaufort Drive after living with her father on Eggert Road in Dundee.
Kim was still settling in as she was not just going through an ordinary week in a familiar routine. She was in a place she had not been living in for a long time, reconnecting with people from earlier in her life and trying to figure out where she fit. From what we know today, she was navigating an immense amount of pressure. Her parents had split up, her home life had been unstable. Different articles and family voices describe her in different ways, but a clearer picture starts to come through when you put those pieces together. She was young, she wasn't perfect, she had made mistakes and even ran away before, but none of that means she should have disappeared and been forgotten. That point is important, because one of the things that happens in older missing persons cases is that the victim can slowly get turned into a rumor instead of a person. The details get flattened, the labels get taken over, a teen becomes a runaway. A missing girl becomes a bad decision, and once that happens, urgency disappears.
On the evening of June 8th, Kim visited Stroh's Ice Cream Parlor near Sheldon and Ann Arbor Roads, where her best friend Brenda was working a shift. This brief stop would be later identified as the final confirmed moment in Kim's timeline. Kim had brought a sweater for Brenda to wear as it was cold inside the ice cream shop. Before parting ways, the pair arranged to meet later that night at Haggerty Fields, a popular hangout spot for teenagers. Yet Kim never arrived. Despite waiting for hours without a word, Brenda eventually realized her friend was not coming, marking the night as the last time anyone could definitively confirm seeing Kim Lero. To help us dig deeper, we sat down with Nina Instead from the Already Gone podcast, where she talks about cold cases and missing persons cases. Here's Nina on the atmosphere surrounding the investigation.
One of the issues with the disappearance of Kim Lero is that nobody knew. She didn't have a lot of friends in Canton. She was just there for the summer. She was staying with her mom. Her mom was working. And Kim was supposedly going up to an ice cream parlor to meet up with people. We don't know if she made it. There's no record of that as far as I know. But then there was also talk that she was going to go up to Haggerty Field to hang out, which was like a local party spot. So we don't know if she made it to either of those places.
A 15-year-old girl goes to see her best friend, makes plans for later that same evening, and then disappears before she ever gets there. If you break this case down to its simplest form, this is the part that hits the hardest. That should have been the moment this case stayed important. When you start looking at decades of reporting, theories, possible suspects, and adjacent cases, it's easy to lose the most basic truth. A kid left to meet a friend and never came home. For us, it's the place to start. Before talking about Arthur Ream, before talking about possible patterns, before talking about dig sites or police theories, the first question had to be, what do we actually know about that night? We know where Kim was last seen, we know she had plans, and we know she never showed up. She'd only been back in Canton for a minute before everything went south. But then, the case just kind of hit a dead end and stopped.
Honestly, that lack of info is what makes this so hard to talk about without screwing it up. When you look at older stories about missing girls, they usually fall into these two traps. Either they get way too emotional and the facts get all blurry, or they get so scientific and just the facts that the person at the center of it, the actual victim, basically disappears from their own story.
Part of the reason why the emotional story of Kim's disappearance is because she did not have any close friends. She navigated a life of dualities, moving not just between physical dwellings, but through a rotating gallery of identities shaped by the demands of others. That does not make her unusual. It makes her 15. When you read older coverage of Kim's case, you can feel that tension. On one hand, she's a missing child. On the other hand, there are hints that people quickly decided she was the kind of kid who might have brought trouble onto herself. This is exactly the kind of thinking that can bury a case before anyone realizes it. And that loss of momentum may be one of the biggest reasons this case is still unsolved.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks,
like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's ScoreCard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
In Kim's case, public records have said she was not reported missing right away. Articles have connected that delay to two things: her past history of running away and the belief that she may have left on her own again. There was also reporting that says her mother was reluctant to cooperating with investigators, and that police later said inconsistent information early in the case hurt the investigation.
Her mother delayed reporting her missing and then was, trying to think of a polite word to use, reluctant to be cooperative with law enforcement in the case, and was like, eh, Kim's run off before. She ran off to Florida with her girlfriend. She's just a runaway. Like, it was all very dismissive of the seriousness of her case.
We want to be careful here. This isn't about blaming one person decades later from behind a microphone. It's about understanding why a case involving a missing 15-year-old seems to have stalled before it ever had a real chance. When you look at it that way, the pattern is frustratingly familiar. A teenager goes missing. Adults assume she is rebellious. Time passes, leads cool off. The case gets harder and harder to solve. Kim had been labeled in a way that may have made it easier for people to think she would come back on her own. In missing person cases, the first hours and days matter. The longer uncertainty sits there, the easier it becomes for witnesses to forget details, for memories to shift, and for opportunities to disappear. A plan that seemed fresh the night before turns into a vague memory a week later. A car someone noticed no longer feels worth mentioning. A face that seemed unusual at the time becomes impossible to place.
That is one reason this case is so frustrating. Even if someone did see something on June 8th, 1981, there is a very real chance that whatever they noticed was not recognized as important soon enough, if it was at all. It also means that later investigations had to work backward through a version of this case that was already damaged by time.
And then there is this emotional side of it. Families do not all respond to the trauma the same way. Some push hard, some shut down, some become defensive, some get blamed for things they did wrong, things that they did not do, or both. What matters for us is not trying to psychoanalyze that from 40-plus years away. What matters is recognizing that the result was an investigation that never seems to have gained the momentum it needed. But according to the people who knew Kim, the idea of her simply just running away and starting a new life never sat right.
Brenda, Kim's best friend, did not believe Kim had just chosen to disappear. In the material our group gathered, Brenda still came across as someone haunted by the memory of that night and by the fact that Kim never showed up where she said she was going to be. Kim's brother Brandon also brings up something important to the story. In public reporting from 2018, when authorities were digging in McCone Township for possible victims connected to Arthur Ream, Brandon spoke openly about his frustration and regret. He said he believes mistakes were made when Kim disappeared. Honestly, that perspective is everything because it makes it feel real instead of just some old story. When you're reading an article, cases like this can feel super distant and abstract. But for the family, the clock doesn't just stop. There's no closure or clean ending. It's just the same question on loop for decades. What actually happened to Kim?
For years, there was no real answer to that question. Then, another case changed everything. That case was the murder of 13-year-old Cindy Zarzicki. Arthur Ream was convicted of Cindy Zarzicki's murder. Public reporting states that Sydney disappeared in 1986 after being lured to a Dairy Queen, and that Ream later led investigators to her burial site in McComb Township in 2008.
That is a case that made Arthur Ream more than just another name in a file. And once investigators knew what he had done to Cindy, they started looking harder at whether he could be connected to other missing girls from the region. That is where Kim Larrow's case comes back into focus. Because by 2018, investigators in Michigan were publicly saying that Arthurine was a main suspect in multiple other disappearances. Reporting from that time connected him to a list of girls who vanished in the 1970s and 80s, and Kim Larrow's name was on that list.
This is the point where we need to draw a line very clearly. Arthurine was convicted in the murder of Cindy Zarzycki. He was not convicted in Kim Larrow's case. Kim's disappearance remains unsolved, but investigators did consider whether Reem might be connected. That is not a rumor. That is a part of the historical record of this case.
Arthur Reem lived in Warren. Warren is in Macomb County, and it is slightly north and slightly east of Detroit. To get to Ann Arbor back then, there was no continuous freeway that would take you from Warren to Ann Arbor. You would do a lot of surface streets. So for him to take Michigan Avenue and cut through Canton out to Ann Arbor, or Ford Road and cut through Canton out to Ann Arbor at that time, would not be a surprise. And because Arthur Reem was a carpet and flooring installer, he went all over the Metro Detroit area and even as far as Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. So it is possible, and they have looked at the possibility that he was doing a job in Ann Arbor at the time Kim disappeared, and that he held her, he took her and got her in his van and then held her for a few days.
By the time Arthur Reem's name enters this story, a lot of damage has already been done by time itself. That is why his relevance feels both important and limited at the same time. Important because he gives investigators a concrete person to examine. Limited because even a strong suspect theory does not erase decades of lost opportunities.
To understand that, we have to keep the details simple. Arthur Reem had a known history of crimes against underage girls. Public records and reporting have described prior sex crime convictions involving minors. That background is part of why his name has carried so much weight once investigators began looking at unsolved disappearances. He was serving a life sentence for Cindy Zarzycki's murder. Investigators said he bragged to inmates about killing additional girls. In 2018, police and the FBI searched land in Macomb Township near the same area where Cindy's body had been found because they believed other victims might be buried there.
And the Macomb Township searches matter for another reason, too. They show that the theory about Reem was not just an internet speculation or true crime rumor. It was something law enforcement spent time, money, and manpower trying to test in the real world. That is one of the bleakest parts of the story. In a case like this, even a recovery can feel like progress. Families can reach a point where certainty, even terrible certainty, starts to feel better than an endless not knowing.
News coverage from that dig named several girls whose cases were being examined in connection with Reem. Kim Larrow, Kimberly King, Kelly Brownlee, Nadine O'Dell, and Cynthia Kuhn. For us, that is the point where this stopped being just an old missing person case and started feeling like a doorway into something larger. But there is also a danger there. Once a case gets attached to a serial killer theory, people can begin treating the theory like a conclusion.
The 2018 dig did not recover human remains. The search raised the profile of the case, but it did not solve Kim's case. Arthur Reem later died in prison in 2024 while serving his life sentence. That means one of the central figures in the border story is no longer alive to answer the questions, deny anything further, or offer information. Whatever we knew, if he knew anything about Kim, may have gone with him, so where does that leave us?
It leaves us in a place that is messy. Arthur Reem is relevant because investigators believed he was relevant. Years later, after investigators began to re-examine the other cases of missing girls connected to Reem, Kim's name resurfaced in connection with those investigations. That connection did not solve her case. It did not prove what happened to her, but it did raise a large and important possibility that investigators took seriously enough to pursue. That is where we're left today. Kim's case is still open, her disappearance is still unexplained, and more than four decades later, people are still trying to figure out whether she was one of Arthur Kim's victims or whether the truth lies somewhere else entirely.
There is another part of this that sticks with us too, and it's not really about evidence. It is about how easy it is for people like Kim to be underestimated. If a victim is young, struggling, complicated, or labeled a runaway, the world can start treating her disappearance like a choice instead of a crisis. Once that happens, attention fades, pressure fades, time passes, the odds get worse. Cases like Kim's can be underestimated by police, the public, the media, and sometimes even by later storytellers who get so caught up in suspects and theories that they stop treating the victim as the center of the story.
Our goal goes behind identifying who might have done this. We are focused on telling the story in a way that restores Kim's dignity, which has been lost over 40 plus years. We know we may not personally solve this case, but these stories deserve persistent attention. Kim was a real person with a life, a waiting friend, and a grieving family. Not just a one-week news cycle. Regardless of Arthur Rehm's involvement, the fact remains that Kim disappeared and no one has ever been held accountable.
Our special thanks to Kim's family and the community members who have kept Kim Laro's story alive, allowing a new generation to pick up the trail. It is important to remember that behind the headlines investigation, there was a real person. Kim Laro was a 15-year-old girl whose life was more than a fleeing news story. She was a daughter and a friend who vanished on a simple walk to an ice cream shop, leaving a void that remains to this day.
Regardless of whether Arthur Rehm was involved, the fact still remains. Kim is still missing, and justice was never served. However, Kim's name doesn't sit alone in the files. She's a part of a haunting list of names. Kimberly King, Kelly Brownlee, Nadine O'Dell, Cynthia Kuhn, and Donna Sarah. Are these cases truly linked, or is the truth even more complicated?
Underestimated. Michigan Missing Angels was researched, written, and produced by Brendan, Tegan, McKenna, and Emery. Intro music by Haley. All other music by Shane Yoder. Our show artwork was created by Chelsea, and our series artwork was created by Tegan. The Underestimated podcast is a production created in the Brandywine Community Schools Broadcasting CTE program. We want to thank you for listening, and a huge thank you to our community sponsors for supporting us and helping us fund our work. Please make sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast player, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Underestimated.